not much else, and as it happened, Quentin was in a mood to fly. In fact, he felt like flying more than he had ever felt like doing anything in his entire life. With no conscious thought or apparent effort, he and his classmates fell into the classic ragged V formation with a fourth year named Georgia at the apex. Georgia was the daughter of the receptionist at a car dealership in Michigan, and she had come here against her family's will. Unlike Quentin, she had confessed fully the nature of break bills, and as a reward for her honesty, Georgia's parents had tried to have her committed. Thanks to Fogg's subtle spellcraft, Georgia's parents believed her to be attending a vocational institute for troubled adults. Now Georgia, whose discipline was an obscure branch of healing roughly analogous to endocrinology, and who wore her wiry black hair cinched at the back with a tortoiseshell barret, was leading them southward, her brand new wings pumping vigorously. It was just chance. Any one of them could have led the flock. Quentin was vaguely aware that although he'd lost the lion's share of his cognitive capacity in the transformation, he'd also picked up a couple of new senses. One had to do with air. He could perceive wind speed and direction and air temperature as clearly as whorls of smoke in a wind tunnel. The sky now appeared to him as a three-dimensional map of currents and eddies, friendly rising heat plumes and dense, dangerous sinks of cool air. He could feel the prickle of distant cumulus clouds swapping bursts of positive and negative electrical charge. Quentin's sense of direction had sharpened, too, to the point where it felt like he had a finely engineered compass floating in oil, perfectly balanced, at the center of his brain. He could feel invisible tracks and rails extending away from him through the air in all directions into the blue distance. They were the Earth's lines of magnetic force, and it was along one of these rails that Georgia was leading them. She was taking them south. By dawn they were a mile up and doing 60 miles an hour, overtaking cars on the Hudson Parkway below them. They passed New York City, a stony encrustation crackling with alien heat and electrical sparks and exuding toxic flatulence. They flew all day, following the coastline, past Trenton and Philadelphia, sometimes over sea, sometimes over frozen fields, surfing the temperature gradients, boosted by updrafts, transferring seamlessly from current to current as one petered out and the next one kicked in. It felt fantastic. Quentin couldn't imagine stopping. He couldn't believe how strong he was, how many wing beats he had stored up in his iron chest muscles. He just couldn't contain himself. He had to talk about it.
"Honk!" he yelled. "Honk, honk, 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 honk!"
His classmates agreed. Quentin was shuffled up and down the V in an orderly fashion, in more or less the same way a volleyball team rotates serve. Sometimes they plonked down and rested and fed in a reservoir or a highway median or a badly drained spot on the lawn of a suburban office park. Landscaping errors were pure gold to geese. Not infrequently they shared these priceless scraps of real estate with other V's, real geese who, sensing their transformed nature, regarded them with polite amusement. How long they flew, Quentin couldn't have said. Once in a while he caught sight of a land formation he recognized, and he tried to calculate time and distance. If they flew at such and such a speed, and the Chesapeake Bay was so many miles south of New York City, then X number of days must have passed since... What again, exactly? The X's and blanks and other equationally such-and-suches stubbornly refused to fill themselves in. They didn't want to do their dance. Quentin's goose brain didn't have the hardware to handle numbers, nor was it interested in whatever point those numbers were supposed to prove anyway. They had gone far enough south now that the weather was perceptibly warmer, and then they went farther still. They went south over the Florida Keys, dry, crusty little nubbins barely poking their heads up out of the ceaselessly lapping turquoise. then out over the Caribbean, bypassing Cuba, farther south than any sensible goose had license to go. They overflew the Panama Canal, no doubt causing any bird watchers who happened to spot them to shake their heads at the lost little V as they dutifully logged it in their bird journals. Days, weeks, maybe months and years passed. Who knew or cared? Quentin had never experienced peace and satisfaction like this. He forgot about his human past, about Brakebills and Brooklyn and James and Julia and Penny and Dean Fogg. Why hang on to them? He had no name anymore. He barely had any individual identity, and he didn't want one. What good were such human artifacts? He was an animal. His job was to turn bugs and plants into muscle and fat and feathers and flight and miles logged. He served only his flock fellows and the wind and the laws of Darwin. And he served whatever force sent him gliding along the invisible magnetic rails, always southward, down the rough, stony coast of Peru, spiny Andes on his port, the sprawling blue Pacific on his starboard. He had never been happier. Though it was tougher going now. They splashed down more rarely and in more exotic locales, widely spaced way stations that must have been picked out for them in advance. He'd be cruising along a mile and a half up, one eye monitoring the rocky rough of the Andes, feeling his empty belly and the ache in his chest muscles, when something would twinkle in the forest 100 miles down the line, and sure enough they'd happen upon a freshly flooded soccer field or an abandoned swimming pool in some Shining Path warlord's ruined villa, rainwater having diluted almost to nothing the lingering chemical tang of chlorine. It was getting colder again after their long tropical interlude. Peru gave way to Chile, and the grassy, wind-ruffled Patagonian pampas. They were a lean flock now, their fat reserves depleted. But nobody turned aside or hesitated for a second as they plunged suicidally south from the tip of Cape Horn out over the terrifying blue chaos of Drake Passage. The invisible highway they rode would brook no swerving. There was no playful intra-flock honking now. Quentin glanced over once at the other branch of the V to see Janet's black button eye burning with furious determination opposite him. They overnighted on a miraculous barge, adrift in deep water and loaded with good things, watercress and alfalfa and clover. When the bleak gray shore of Antarctica heaved up over the horizon, they regarded it not with relief but with collective resignation. This was no respite. There were no goose names for this country, because geese didn't come here. Or if they did, they never came back. He could see magnetic tracks and rails converging in the air here, carving in from far away on either side, like the longitude lines that come crowding together at the bottom of a globe. The Brakebill's V flew high, the wrinkled gray swells telescopically clear below them through 2 miles of dry, salted air. Instead of a beach, a fringe of tumbled boulders crammed with bizarre, unintelligible penguins crept by, then blank white ice, the frozen skull of the earth. Quentin was tired. The cold tore at his little body through its thin, feathery jacket. He no longer knew what was keeping them aloft. If one of them dropped, he knew, they would all give up, just fold their wings and dive for the porcelain white snow, which would happily devour them. And then the rail they followed dipped like a dowser's rod. It angled them downward, and they slipped and slid gratefully down it, accepting a loss of altitude in exchange for speed and blessed relief from the effort of maintaining height with their burning wings. Quentin could see now that there was a stone house there in the snow, an anomaly in the otherwise featureless plain. It was a place of men, and ordinarily Quentin would have feared it, crapped on it, and then blown by it and forgotten it. But no, there was no question. Their track ended there. It buried itself in one of the stone house's many snowy roofs. They were close enough now that Quentin could see a man standing on one of them, waiting for them, holding a long, straight staff. The urge to fly from him was strong, but exhaustion and above all the magnetic logic of the track were stronger. At the very last second, he cupped his stiffened wings, and they caught the air like a sail, snatching up the last of his kinetic energy and breaking his fall. He plopped onto the snow roof and lay there gasping at the thin atmosphere. His eyes went dull. The human hadn't moved. Well, fuck him. He could do what he wanted with them, pluck them and gut them and stuff them and roast them. Quentin didn't care anymore as long as he could just have one blessed moment of rest for his aching wings. The man shaped a strange syllable with his fleshy, beakless lips, and tapped the base of his staff on the roof. 15 pale, naked, human teenagers lay in the snow under the white polar sun. Quentin woke up in a bare, white bedroom. He could not have guessed to the nearest 24 hours how long he'd been asleep. His chest and arms felt bruised and achy. He looked at his crude pink human hands with their stubby featherless fingers. He brought them up to touch his face. He sighed and resigned himself to being a man again. There was very little in the bedroom, and all of it was white. The bedclothes, the whitewashed walls, the coarse drawstring pajamas he wore, the white-painted iron bedstead, the slippers waiting for him on the cold stone floor. From the small square window, Quentin could see he was on the second floor. His view was of broken snowfields beneath a white sky, stretching out to the horizon, a meaningless abstract white line, an unjudgeable distance away. My God, what had he gotten himself into? Quentin shuffled out into the corridor, still in his pajamas and a thin robe he'd found hanging on a hook on the back of the door. He found his way downstairs into a quiet, airy hall with a timbered ceiling. It was identical to the dining hall at Brakebill's, but the vibe was different, more like an alpine ski lodge. A long table with benches ran most of the length of the hall. Quentin sat down. A man sat alone at one end of the table, nursing a mug of coffee and staring bleakly at the picked-over remains of a lavish breakfast. He was sandy-haired, tall but round-shouldered, with a weak chin and the beginnings of a paunch. His dressing gown was much whiter and fluffier than Quentin's. His eyes were a pale, watery green.
"I'll let you sleep," he said. "Most of the others are already up."
"Thanks." Quentin scooched down the bench to sit across from him. He rummaged through the leftover plates and dishes for a clean fork.
"You are at Brakebill's South."
The man's voice was oddly flat, with a slight Russian accent, and he didn't look directly at Quentin when he talked.
"We are about 500 miles from the South Pole. You flew in over the Bellingshausen Sea on your way from Chile, over a region called Ellsworth Land. They call this part of Antarctica Marie Bird Land. Admiral Bird named it after his wife."
He scratched his tousled hair unself-consciously. "Where's everybody else?" Quentin asked. There didn't seem to be any point in being formal, since they were both wearing bathrobes, and the cold hash browns were unbelievably good. He hadn't realized how hungry he was.
"I gave them the morning." He waved in no particular direction. "Classes begin in the afternoon."
Quentin nodded, his mouth full. "What kind of classes?" he managed.
"What kind of classes?" the man repeated. Here at Breakbill South you will begin your education in magic. Or I suppose you thought that was what you were doing with Professor Fogg?
Questions like that always confused Quentin, so he resorted to honesty. Yes, I did think that.
You are here to internalize the essential mechanisms of magic. You think,
his accent made it think,
that you have been studying magic. Magic. You have practiced your popper and memorized your conjugations and declensions and modifications. What are the five tertiary circumstances?
It popped out automatically. Altitude, age, position of the Pleiades, phase of the moon, nearest body of water.
Very good, he said sarcastically. Magnificent. You are a genius.
With an effort, Quentin decided not to be stung by this. He was still enjoying the zen afterglow of having been a goose. And the hash browns. Thank you.
You have been studying magic the way a parrot studies Shakespeare. You recite it like you are saying the Pledge of Allegiance, but you do not understand it.
I don't?
To become a magician, you must do something very different, the man said.
This was clearly his set piece.
You cannot study magic. You cannot learn it. You must ingest it, digest it. You must merge with it, and it with you. When a magician casts a spell, he does not first mentally review the major, minor, tertiary, and quaternary circumstances. He does not search his soul to determine the phase of the moon, and the nearest body of water, and the last time he wiped his ass. When he wishes to cast a spell, he simply casts it. When he wishes to fly, he simply flies. When he wants the dishes done, they simply are.
The man muttered something, tapped once resonantly on the table, and the dishes began noisily arranging themselves into stacks, as if they were magnetized.
You need to do more than memorize, Quentin. You must learn the principles of magic with more than your head. You must learn them with your bones, with your blood, your liver, your heart, your dick.
He grabbed his crotch through his dressing gown and gave it a shake.
We are going to submerge the language of spellcasting deep into who you are, so that you have it always, wherever you are, whenever you need it, not just when you have studied for a test. You are not going on a mystical adventure here, Quentin. This process will be long and painful and humiliating and very, very,
he practically shouted the word,
boring. It is a task best performed in silence and isolation. That is the reason for your presence here. You will not enjoy the time you spend at Breakbill South. I do not encourage you to try.
Quentin listened to this in silence. He didn't especially like this man who had just referred to his penis, and whose name he still didn't know. He put it out of his mind and focused on cramming starch into his depleted body. So how do I do that? Quentin mumbled. Learn things in my bones, or whatever.
It is very hard. Not everybody does. Not everybody can.
Uh-huh. What happens if I can't?
Nothing. You go back to Breakbills. You graduate. You spend your life as a second-rate magician. Many do. Probably you never realize it. Even the fact that you failed is beyond your ability to comprehend.
Quentin had no intention of letting that happen to him. though it occurred to him that probably nobody actually set out to have that happen to them, and statistically speaking, it had to happen to somebody. The hash browns no longer tasted quite so scrumptious. He put his fork down.
"Fogg tells me you are good with your hands,"
the sandy-haired man said, relenting a little.
"Show me."
Quentin's fingers were still stiff and sore from having served as wings, but he picked up a sharp knife that looked decently balanced, carefully cleaned it off with a napkin, and held it between the last two fingers in his left hand. He spun it, finger by finger, as far as his thumb, then he tossed it up almost to the ceiling, still spinning, careful to let it pass between two rafters, with the idea that it would fall and bury itself in the table between the third and fourth fingers of his outstretched left hand. This was best done without looking, maintaining eye contact with his audience for maximum effect. Quentin's breakfast companion picked up a loaf of bread and stuck it out so that the falling knife speared it. He tossed loaf and knife contemptuously on the table.
"You take stupid risks," the man said stonily. "Go on and join your friends. I think you will find them on the roof of the West Tower."
He pointed to a doorway.
"We begin in the afternoon."
"Okay, Mr. Funny Laughs," Quentin thought. "You're the boss." He stood up. The stranger stood up, too, and shuffled off in another direction. He had the air of a disappointed man. Stone for stone, board for board, Breakbills South was the same house as the house at Breakbills. Which was reassuring in a way, but it was incongruous to find what looked like an 18th-century English country house planted in the middle of a soaring Antarctic wasteland. The roof of the West Tower was broad and round and paved with smooth flagstones, with a stone wall running around the edge. It was open to the elements, but some kind of magical arrangement kept the air warm and humid and protected it from the wind, or mostly. Quentin imagined he could feel a deep chill lurking underneath the warmth somewhere. The air was tepid, but the floor, the furniture, everything he touched was cool and clammy. It was like being in a warm greenhouse in the dead of winter. As promised, the rest of the Breakbills group was up there, standing around, dazed in threes and fours, staring out at the snowpack and talking in low tones, bathed in the eerie, even Antarctic light. They looked different. Their waists were trimmer, and their shoulders and chests were sturdier, huskier. They'd lost fat and packed on muscle during their flight south. Their jaws and cheekbones were sharply defined. Alice looked lovely and gaunt and lost.
"Honk, honk, 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 honk!"
Janet said when she saw Quentin. People laughed, though Quentin had the impression she'd already made that joke a few times.
"Hey, man,"
Josh said, trying to sound nonchalant.
"Is this place fucked up or what?"
"Doesn't seem so bad," Quentin said. "What time is skinny dipping?"
"I might have been a little off base with that," Elliot said gloomily, also probably not for the first time. "We did all get naked, anyway."
They were all wearing identical white pajamas. Quentin felt like an inmate in an insane asylum. He wondered if Elliot was missing his secret boyfriend of the moment, whoever it was.
"I ran into Nurse Ratched downstairs," he said.
The pajamas had no pockets, and Quentin kept looking for somewhere to put his hands. "He gave me a speech about how stupid I am and how miserable he's going to make me."
"You slept through our little meet-and-greet. That's Professor Mayakovsky."
"Mayakovsky? Like Dean Mayakovsky?"
"He's the son," Elliot said. "I always wondered what happened to him. Now we know." The original Mayakovsky had been the most powerful magician in a wave of international faculty brought in during the 1930s and 1940s. Until then, Brakebills taught English and American magic almost exclusively, but in the 1930s, a vogue for multicultural spellcasting had swept the school. Professors were imported at huge expense from around the world, the more remote the better. Skirt-wearing shamans from Micronesian dot islands, hunch-shouldered, hookah-puffing wizards from inner-city Cairo coffee houses, blue-faced Tuareg necromancers from southern Morocco. Legend had it that Mayakovsky Sr. was recruited from a remote Siberian location, a cluster of frozen Soviet blockhouses where local shamanic traditions had hybridized with sophisticated Muscovite practices brought there by gulag inmates.
"I wonder how badly you have to fuck up to get this assignment," Josh mused.
"Maybe he wanted it," Quentin said. "Maybe he likes it here. Dude must be in creepy loner heaven."
"I think you were right. I think I'm going to be the first one to crack," Elliot said, as if he were having a different conversation. He felt the fluffy stubble on his cheek. "I don't like it here. This stuff is giving me a rash."
He fingered the material of the Brakebills' South pajamas. "I think it might have a stain on it." Janet rubbed his arm comfortingly. "You'll be okay. You survived Oregon. Is this worse than Oregon?"
"Maybe if I ask nicely, he'll turn me back into a goose."
"Oh, my God," said Alice. "Never again.
Do you realize we ate bugs? We ate bugs!"
"What do you mean, never again? How do you think we're getting back?"
"You know what I liked about being a goose?" Josh said. "Being able to crap wherever I wanted."
"I'm not going back." Elliot threw a white pebble out into the white bleakness, where it became invisible before it hit the ground. "I could fly to Australia from here. Or New Zealand. The vineyards there are really coming along. Some nice sheep farmer will adopt me and feed me Sauvignon Blanc and turn my liver into a wonderful foie gras."
"Maybe Professor Mayakovsky can turn you into a kiwi bird," Josh said helpfully.
"Kiwi birds can't fly." "Anyway, he didn't strike me as the kind of guy who's going to do us a lot of favors," Alice said.
"He must spend a lot of time alone," Quentin said. "I wonder if we should feel bad for him."
Janet snorted.
"Honk, honk, 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 honk!"
There was no reliable way to measure time at Brakebills South. There were no clocks, and the sun was a dull white fluorescence permanently thumbtacked half an inch above the white horizon. It made Quentin think of the Watcherwoman, how she was always trying to stop time. She would have loved this place. That first morning they talked and mingled on the roof of the West Tower for what felt like hours, huddling together to cope with all the strangeness. Nobody felt like going back downstairs, even after they got tired of standing and ran out of things to talk about, so they all sat around the edge of the roof with their backs against the stone wall and just stared off into the pale, hazy distance, bathed in the weird, directionless, all-permeating white light reflecting off the snow. Quentin leaned his back against the cool stone and closed his eyes. He felt Alice put her head on his shoulder. If nothing else, he could hang on to her. Whatever else changed, she was always the same. They rested. Later, it might have been minutes or hours or days, he opened his eyes. He tried to say something and discovered that he couldn't talk. Some of the others were on their feet already. Professor Mayakovsky had appeared at the head of the stairs, his white bathrobe belted over his gut. He cleared his throat.
"I've taken the liberty of depriving you of the power of speech," he said.
He tapped his Adam's apple.
"There will be no talking at Brakebills South. It is the hardest thing to adjust to, and I find it eases the transition if I simply prevent you from speaking for your first weeks here. You may vocalize for the purposes of spellcasting, but for no other reason."
The class stared at him mutely. Mayakovsky seemed to be more comfortable now that nobody could answer back.
"If you will all follow me downstairs, it is time for your first lesson."
One thing had always confused Quentin about the magic he read about in books. It never seemed especially hard to do. There were lots of furrowed brows and thick books and long white beards and whatnot, but when it came right down to it, you memorized the incantation, or you just read it off the page if that was too much trouble. You collected the herbs, waved the wand, rubbed the lamp, mixed the potion, said the words, and just like that, the forces of the beyond did your bidding. It was like making salad dressing, or driving stick, or assembling IKEA furniture. Just another skill you could learn. It took some time and effort, but compared to doing calculus, say, or playing the oboe, well, there really was no comparison. Any idiot could do magic. Quentin had been perversely relieved when he learned that there was more to it than that. Talent was part of it, that silent, invisible exertion he felt in his chest every time a spell came out right. But there was also work, hard work, mountains of it. Every spell had to be adjusted and modified in 100 ways according to the prevailing circumstances. They adorned the word with a capital letter at Breakbills, under which it was cast. These circumstances could be just about anything. Magic was a complicated, fiddly instrument that had to be calibrated precisely to the context in which it operated. Quentin had committed to memory dozens of pages of closely printed charts and diagrams spelling out the major circumstances and how they affected any given enchantment. And then, once you had all that down, there were hundreds of corollaries and exceptions to memorize, too. As much as it was like anything, magic was like a language. And like a language, textbooks and teachers treated it as an orderly system for the purposes of teaching it. But in reality, it was complex and chaotic and organic. It obeyed rules only to the extent that it felt like it. And there were almost as many special cases and one-time variations as there were rules. These exceptions were indicated by rows of asterisks and daggers and other more obscure typographical fauna which invited the reader to peruse the many footnotes that cluttered up the margins of magical reference books like Talmudic commentary. It was Mayakovsky's intention to make them memorize all these minutiae, and not only to memorize them, but to absorb and internalize them. The very best spellcasters had talent, he told his captive, silent audience, but they also had unusual, under-the-hood mental machinery, the delicate but powerful correlating and cross-checking engines necessary to access and manipulate and manage this vast body of information. That first afternoon, Quentin expected a lecture. But instead, when Mayakovsky was done jinxing their larynxes, he showed each of them to what looked like a monk's cell, a small stone room with a single high, barred window, a single chair, and a single square wooden table. A shelf of magical reference books was bolted to one wall. It had the clean, industrious air of a room that had just been vigorously swept with a birch twig broom.
"Sit," Mayakovsky said.
Quentin sat. The professor placed in front of him, one by one, like a man setting up a chessboard, a hammer, a block of wood, a box of nails, a sheet of paper, and a small book bound in pale vellum. Mayakovsky tapped the paper.
"Hammer charm of Le Grand," he said. "You know it?"
Everybody knew it. It was a standard teaching charm. While simple in theory, all it did was ensure that a hammered nail would go in straight in one shot, It was extraordinarily persnickety to cast. It existed in literally thousands of permutations, depending on the circumstances. Casting Legrand was probably harder than just hammering the damn nail in the old-fashioned way, but it came in handy for didactic purposes. Mayakovsky tapped the book with a thick-nailed finger.
"This book, each page describes a different set of circumstances. All different. Understand? Place, weather, stars, season. You will see. You turn the page, you cast the spell according to each set of circumstances. Good practice. I'll come back when you finish book. Korosho?"
Mayakovsky's Russian accent was getting thicker as the day wore on. He was dropping his contractions and definite articles. He closed the door behind him. Quentin opened the book. Somebody not very creative had written, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here," on the first page. Something told Quentin that Mayakovsky had noticed the graffiti, but let it stand. Soon Quentin knew Legrand's hammer charm better than he wanted to know any spell ever. Page by page, the circumstances listed in the book became more and more esoteric and counterfactual. He cast Legrand's hammer charm at noon and at midnight, in summer and winter, on mountain tops and 1,000 yards beneath the earth's surface. He cast the spell underwater and on the surface of the moon. He cast it in early evening during a blizzard on a beach on the island of Mangareva, which would almost certainly never happen since Mangareva is part of French Polynesia in the South Pacific. He cast the spell as a man, as a woman, and once—was this really relevant—as a hermaphrodite. He cast it in anger, with ambivalence, and with bitter regret. By then Quentin's mouth was dry, his fingertips were numb. He had pounded his thumb with the hammer 4 times. The block of wood was now crammed with flattened iron nail heads. Quentin groaned soundlessly and let his head loll back against the hard back of the chair. The door flew open, and Professor Mayakovsky entered carrying a jingling tray. He set the tray down on the desk. It supported a cup of hot tea, a tumbler of water, a plate with a pat of yeasty European butter and a thick slab of sourdough bread on it, and a glass containing what would turn out to be 2 fingers of peppery vodka, 1 finger of which Mayakovsky drank off himself before placing it on the table. When he was done, he slapped Quentin hard across the face.
"That is for doubting yourself," he said.
Quentin stared at him. He lifted a hand to his cheek, thinking, "This man is batshit insane. He could do anything to us out here." Mayakovsky turned the book back to the first page again. He turned the piece of paper with the spell on it over and patted it. On the back was written another spell, Bujold's Sorcerous Nail Extraction.
"Begin again, please."
Wax on, wax off. When Mayakovsky was gone, Quentin stood up and stretched. Both his knees cracked. Instead of beginning again, he went over to the tiny window looking out on the lunar snowfields. The sheer monochromaticity of the landscape was beginning to make him hallucinate colors. The sun had not moved at all. That was how Quentin's first month at Breakbills South went. The spells changed, and the circumstances were different, but the room was the same, and the days were always, always, always the same. Empty, relentless, interminable wastelands of repetition. Mayakovsky's ominous warnings had been entirely justified and arguably a little understated. Even during his worst moments at Breakbills, Quentin had always had a niggling suspicion that he was getting away with something by being there, that the sacrifices asked of him by his instructors, however great, were cheap by comparison with the rewards of the life he could look forward to as a magician. At Breakbills South, for the first time, He felt like he was giving value for money. And he understood why they'd been sent here. What Mayakovsky was asking of them was impossible. The human brain was not meant to ingest these quantities of information. If Fogg had tried to enforce this regimen back at Breakbills, there would have been an insurrection. It was difficult to gauge how the others were holding up. They met at mealtimes and passed in the hall, but because of the prohibition against speech, there was no commiserating, just glances and shrugs, and not much of that. Their gazes met bleakly over the breakfast table and turned away. Elliot's eyes were empty, and Quentin supposed his own probably looked the same way. Even Janet's animated features were set and frozen. No notes were exchanged. Whatever enchantment kept them from talking was global. Their pens wouldn't write. Quentin was losing interest in communicating anyway. He should have been ravenous for human contact, but instead he felt himself falling away from the others, deeper inside himself. He shuffled like a prisoner from bedroom to dining room to solitary classroom, down the stone corridors under the tediously unblinking gaze of the white sun. Once he wandered up to the roof of the West Tower and found one of the others, a gangly extrovert named Dale, putting on a mime show for a listless audience, but it really wasn't worth the effort of turning his head to follow what was going on. His sense of humor had died in the vastness. Professor Mayakovsky seemed to expect this, as if he'd known it was going to happen. After the first 3 weeks, he announced that he had lifted the spell that kept them from talking. The news was received in silence. Nobody had noticed. Mayakovsky began to vary the routine. Most days were still devoted to grinding through the circumstances and their never-ending exceptions, but once in a while he introduced other exercises. In an empty hall, he erected a three-dimensional maze composed of wire rings through which the students would levitate objects at speed to sharpen their powers of concentration and control. At first they used marbles, then later steel balls only slightly narrower than the rings. When a ball brushed a ring, a spark cracked between them, and the spellcaster felt a shock. Later still, they would guide fireflies through the same maze, influencing their tiny insect minds by force of will. They watched one another do this in silence, feeling envy at one another's successes and contempt for one another's failures. The regime had divided them against each other. Janet, in particular, was bad at it. She tended to overpower her fireflies to the point where they would crisp up in midair and become puffs of ash. Mayakovsky, stony-faced, just made her start over, while tears of wordless frustration ran down her face. This could and did go on for hours. No one could leave the hall before everyone had completed the exercise. They slept there more than once. As the weeks went by, and still no one spoke, they plowed deeper and deeper into areas of magic Quentin never thought he'd have the guts to try. They practiced transformations. He learned to unpack and parse the spell that had turned them into geese. Much of the trick, it turned out, was in shedding, storing, and then restoring the difference in body mass. They spent a hilarious afternoon as polar bears, wandering clumsily in a herd over the packed snow, swatting harmlessly at each other with giant yellow paws, encased as they were in layers of fur, hide, and fat. Their bare bodies felt clumsy and top-heavy, and they kept toppling over sideways onto their backs by accident. More hilarity. Nobody liked him, but it became apparent that Mayakovsky was no fraud. He could do things Quentin had never seen done at Breakbills, things he didn't think had been done for centuries. One afternoon, he demonstrated, but did not allow them to try, a spell that reversed the flow of entropy. He smashed a glass globe and then neatly restored it again, like a film clip run in reverse. He popped a helium balloon and then knitted it back together and refilled it with its original helium atoms, in some cases fishing them from deep inside the lungs of spectators who had inhaled them. He used camphor to smother a spider. He showed no particular remorse about this, and then, frowning with the effort, brought the spider back to life. Quentin watched the poor thing creep around in circles on the tabletop, hopelessly traumatized, making little dazed rushes at nothing and then retreating to a corner, hunched up and twitching, while Mayakovsky moved on to another topic. One day, about 3 months into the semester, Mayakovsky announced that they would be transforming into Arctic foxes for the afternoon. It was an odd choice. They'd already done a few mammals, and it was no tougher than becoming a goose. But why quibble? Being an Arctic fox turned out to be a hell of a lot of fun. As soon as the change was in effect, Quentin shot out across the snowpack on his four twinkling paws. His little fox body was so fast and light, and his eyes were so close to the ground that it was like flying a high-performance jet at low altitude. Tiny ridges and crumbs of snow loomed up like mountains and boulders. He leaped over them and dodged around them and crashed through them. When he tried to turn, he was going so fast he skidded and wiped out in a huge plume of snow. The rest of the pack gleefully piled on top of him, yipping and yapping and snapping. It was an amazing outpouring of collective joy. Quentin had forgotten he was capable of that emotion, the way a lost spelunker feels like there never was such a thing as sunlight, that it was just a cruel fiction. They chased one another around in circles, panting and rolling and acting like idiots. It was funny, Quentin thought, with his stupid little miniature fox brain, the way he could automatically recognize everybody as foxes. That was Elliot with the snaggle teeth. That plump blue-white critter was Josh. That small, silky specimen with the wide eyes was Alice. Somewhere in the goofing off, a game spontaneously evolved. It had something to do with pushing around a chunk of ice with your paws and your nose as fast as possible. Beyond that, the point of the game wasn't really clear, but they frantically pounced on the chunk of ice, or pounced on whoever had pounced on it just before them, and pushed it until the next person pounced on them. An Arctic fox's eyes weren't all that much to brag about, but its nose was unbelievable. Quentin's new nose was a goddamn sensory masterpiece. Even in the middle of the fray, he could recognize classmates by snuffing their fur. Increasingly, Quentin noticed one scent more than the others. It was a sharp, acrid, skunky musk that probably would have smelled like cat piss to a human being, but to a fox, it was like a drug. He caught flashes of it in the fray every few minutes, and every time he did, it grabbed his attention and jerked him around like a fish on a hook. Something was happening to the game. It was losing its cohesion. Quentin was still playing, but fewer and fewer of his fellow foxes were playing with him. Elliot lit out in a streak off into the snow dunes. The pack dwindled to 10, then 8. Where were they going? Quentin's fox brain barked. And what the hell was that unbefucking-leavable smell he kept stumbling on? There it was again. This time he tackled the source of the smell, buried his snuffling muzzle in her fur, because of course he had known all along, with what was left of his consciousness, that what he was smelling was Alice. It was totally against the rules, but breaking the rules turned out to be as much fun as obeying them. How had he never figured that out before? The others were playing more and more wildly. They weren't even trying to go after the chunk of ice anymore, and the game was disintegrating into little knots of tussling foxes, and he was tussling with Alice. Vulpine hormones and instincts were powering up, taking over, manhandling what was left of his rational human mind. He locked his teeth in the thick fur of her neck. It didn't seem to hurt her any, or at least not in a way that was easily distinguishable from pleasure, Something crazy and urgent was going on, and there was no way to stop it, or probably there was, but why would you? Stopping was one of those pointless, life-defeating human impulses for which his merry little fox brain had nothing but contempt. He caught a glimpse of Alice's wild, dark fox's eye, rolling with terror and then half-shutting with pleasure. Their tiny, quick breaths puffed white in the air and mingled and disappeared. Her white fox fur was coarse and smooth at the same time, and she made little yipping snarls every time he pushed himself deeper inside her. He never wanted to stop. The snow burned underneath them. It glowed hot like a bed of coals. They were on fire, and they let the fire consume them. To an outside observer, breakfast the next day wouldn't have looked much different than it usually did. Everybody shuffled in their loose-fitting, all-white Brakebills South uniforms, sat down without speaking or looking at one another, and ate what was put in front of them. But Quentin felt like he was walking on the moon. Giant, slow-motion steps, ringing silence, vacuum all around him, a television audience of millions. He didn't dare look at anybody else, least of all Alice. She was sitting across the table and three people down from him, impassive and unperturbed, calmly focused on her oatmeal. He couldn't have guessed within a light year what she was thinking, though he knew what was on everybody else's minds. He was sure they all knew what had happened. They'd been right out in the open, for God's sake. Or had they all been doing the same thing? Did everybody pair off? His face felt hot. He didn't even know if she was a virgin. Or if she had been, whether she still was one. It would all be so much simpler if he even understood what it meant, but he didn't. Could he be in love with Alice? He tried to compare what he felt for her with his remembered feelings for Julia, but the two emotions were worlds apart. Things just got out of control, that's all. It wasn't them, it was their fox bodies. Nobody had to take it too seriously. Mayakovsky sat at the head of the table, looking smug. He had known this was going to happen, Quentin thought furiously, stabbing at his cheese grits with a fork. A bunch of teenagers cooped up in the fortress of solitude for 2 months, then stuck in the bodies of stupid horny animals. Of course we were going to go crazy. Whatever perverted personal satisfaction Mayakovsky got out of what happened, it became obvious over the next week that it was also a practical piece of personnel management, because Quentin reapplied himself to his magical studies with the laser-like focus of a person desperate to avoid meeting anybody else's eyes or thinking about things that actually mattered, like how he really felt about Alice, and who it was who had had sex with her out on the ice, him or the fox. It was back to the grind, pounding his way through circumstances and exceptions and 1,000 mnemonics designed to force him to embed 1,000 trivial particles of data in the soft tissue of his already supersaturated mind. They fell into a collective, tribal trance. The depleted palate of the Antarctic world hypnotized them. The shifting snows outside briefly revealed a low ridge of dark shale, the only topographical feature in a featureless world, and the students watched it from the roof like television. It reminded him of the desert in The Wandering Dune. God, he hadn't thought about Fillory for ages. Quentin wondered if the rest of the world, his life before this, had just been a lurid dream. When he pictured the globe now, it was entirely Antarctic, a whole world over which this monochromatic continent had metastasized like an icy cancer. He went a little insane. They all did, though it took them in different ways. Some of the others became obsessed with sex. Their higher functions were so numb and exhausted they became animals, desperate for any kind of contact that wouldn't ask words of them. Impromptu orgies were not unheard of. Quentin came upon them once or twice in the evenings. They would gather in apparently arbitrary combinations, in an empty classroom or in somebody's bedroom, in semi-anonymous chains, their white uniforms half or all the way off, their eyes glassy and bored as they pulled and stroked and pumped, always in silence. He saw Janet take part once. The display was as much for other people as for themselves, but Quentin never joined in or even watched, just turned away feeling superior and also strangely angry. Maybe he was just angry that something kept him from jumping in. He was disproportionately relieved that he never saw Alice there. Time passed, or at least Quentin knew that according to theory it pretty much had to be passing, though he didn't personally see much evidence of it, unless you counted the weird menagerie of mustaches and beards he and his male classmates were growing. However much he ate, he got thinner and thinner. His state of mind devolved from mesmerized to hallucinatory. Tiny random things became charged with overwhelming significance. A round pebble, a stray straw from a broom, a dark mark on a white wall that dissipated again minutes later. In the classroom he sometimes saw fantastical creatures mixed in with his classmates, a huge, elegant, brown stick insect that clung to the back of a chair, a giant lizard with horny skin and a German accent, whose head burned with white fire, though afterward he could never be sure if he had imagined them. Once he thought he saw the man whose face was hidden by a branch. He couldn't take this much longer. Then, just like that, one morning over breakfast, Mayakovsky announced that there were 2 weeks remaining in the semester, and it was time they gave serious thought to the final exam. The test was simply this. They would walk from Brakeville South to the South Pole. The distance was on the order of 500 miles. They would be given no food and no maps and no clothing. They would have to protect and sustain themselves by magic. Flying was out of bounds. They would go on foot or not at all, and in the form of human beings, not as bears or penguins or some other naturally cold-resistant animal. Cooperation between students was prohibited. They could view it as a race if they liked. There was no time limit. The exam was not mandatory. 2 weeks wasn't quite long enough to prepare properly, but it was more than long enough for the decision to hang over them. Yes or no, in or out. Mayakovsky stressed that safety precautions would be minimal. He would do his best to keep track of them in the field, but there was no guarantee that if they screwed up, he'd be able to rescue their sorry hypothermic asses. There was a lot to study up on. Would sunburn be a problem? Snow blindness? Should they toughen the soles of their feet or try to create some kind of magical footwear? Was there any way to get mutton fat, which they could need to cast Shkartishvili's enveloping warmth from the kitchen? And if the test wasn't even mandatory, then what was the point of it? What would happen if they failed? It sounded more like a ritual or a hazing than a final exam. On the last morning, Quentin got up early with the idea of foraging for contraband spell components in the kitchen. He had made up his mind to compete. He had to know if he could do it or not. It was that simple. Most of the cupboards were locked. He probably wasn't the first student to have thought of it, but he did manage to load up his pockets with flour and a stray silver fork and some old sprouting garlic cloves that might come in handy for something. He didn't know what. He headed downstairs. Alice was waiting for him on the landing between floors. "I have to ask you something," she said, her voice full of crisp determination.
Are you in love with me? It's okay if you aren't. I just want to know.
She made it almost all the way through, but she couldn't quite say the last phrase full voice and whispered it instead. He hadn't even met her eyes since the afternoon they'd been foxes together.